Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor.
And I'm John Perry. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW here in lovely San Francisco. Well, at least I am. I can't see Ken anywhere. Where are you, Ken?
I'm down under, John. I'm in Canberra, Australia, at the studios of the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, where I'm here because I'm a visiting fellow at the Australian National University. It's a great place.
Well, it's a great place, and it's great that you're there, but I question your intelligence, frankly, because you gave up a California summer for an Australia winter.
Well, but this place is a hotbed of philosophical activity, so I'm having a great time despite the winter.
Well, Ken's in Australia, and I'm here in San Francisco. We're continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus.
And from there, they migrate to the air via the signal of KALW. And from the air, they migrate to the internet via our blog, theblog.philosophytalk.org. Go check it out.
Today we're talking about emotions. Now, emotions include things like anger, joy, envy, jealousy, love, shame, disgust, guilt, and many others. Ken, usually when we think about the mind, we divide it into thoughts, parts of thinking, you know, that's kind of just pretty ethereal, and sensations or feelings like pain that really feel like something, but they're quite different from thoughts. But where do emotions fit into that?
Well, it depends on who you talk to. Philosophers have said everything possible about the emotions. They're bodily responses of some kind. They're feelings that aren't quite bodily responses. They're thoughts. I mean, there's an intuitive difference, though, between a thought and a feeling. Look, I think dispassionately, calmly, there's a bear over there. He's about to eat me, right? And there's no emotion there. But suppose I think, there's a bear over there. He's about to eat me. I better run, right? The first is kind of emotionless, and the second is suffused with feeling.
So it wouldn't be anger if you didn't have that thought there. It wouldn't be fear. You got to be fearful about something. But just to think that you're in danger isn't enough. There does seem to be a feeling element in there. But you think some philosophers don't agree with that?
Well, it's a complicated thing. There's another kind of question. What are the emotions good for? You know, Hume wanted to base all of ethics basically on the emotions. Go back to Aristotle. He thought that ethics had the emotions had a role in ethics, but only a certain role. Go up to Kant. He thought, my God, we should just banish the emotions from ethical considerations. 20th century, the emotions just dropped out for a long time, and now they're kind of back. So, you know, it's a big deal, this stuff about the emotions.
My favorite philosopher, Hume, said that reason is and ought to be the slave of the passions. And by the passions, he meant the emotions. I'll bet your favorite philosopher, Kant, didn't agree with that at all.
No, he didn't agree with that at all. Again, he just thought if you acted on the emotion, you couldn't be living a morally correct life. The emotions just could not be proper motivations for a morally good person. But you know what? That debate about between Kant and Hume, it's also played out in popular culture. And a roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, files this report.
Captain's log, stardate 412.
We're watching Star Trek, The Next Generation, and Data, Starship Enterprise's favorite android, is about to come home.
Home of our android crew member, Lieutenant Commander Data. Although we're due at our next assignment, I have decided to visit Data's home planet for a few hours in the hopes of unraveling some of the mystery of his beginnings.
Sir, we are now 20 minutes from Omicron Theta.
While exploring his home planet, Data discovers another android who looks exactly like him. For a robot, Data sounds pretty excited about the discovery.
Data, we don't know that this can become alive.
It is very important for me to know that, sir. I never dreamed it was possible that I might find some link with a form like my own.
Understood. We'll take it back to the ship with us.
Data is said to not have emotions. He also says he never has feelings.
Linda Wetzel teaches a course called Philosophy and Star Trek at Georgetown University.
And yet there are many episodes where he does things which we would naturally describe as expressing puzzlement or expressing anticipation or gratitude or something. The most spectacular example being he wants to have emotions. He desires emotions. He wants to be human. He's pining for it, almost, one might say. Now, if these aren't terms for emotions, I don't know what they are. To say that he doesn't have emotions is just false.
What Data doesn't seem to do is get angry or envious.
Perhaps if we make some sort of distinction between higher emotions and lower emotions and say that, you know, lower emotions like rage, for example, that's the sort of very intense emotion that he's not capable of. But that he is capable of these sort of higher order emotions that have a powerful intellectual component.
Do some emotions involve our intellect and others not? Data's brother Lore, it turns out, was designed to have emotions, mostly the lower kind. And he says this makes him more human than Data could ever be.
Haven't you noticed how easily I handle human speech? I use their contractions. For example, I say can't or isn't. And you say, cannot, and is not. I say tomato, and you say tomato. I say potato, and you say potato. Yeah. A very old joke. But then you also have trouble with her humor. Am I right?
Does it take emotions to get jokes? If Data were really true to character, maybe he wouldn't have a sense of humor. But he wouldn't be happy to see his brother, either. Still, it's hard to fault the scriptwriters. What kind of character do you make out of a robot with no emotions whatsoever?
I guess it would have to be something that was perfectly machine-like, just has a function and performs its function, and like a garage door opener can do things. It can open the garage door. It has a sensing device for when the car comes home, and it can open the door. And the computer, which we would say doesn't have emotions, doesn't have feelings. But whether we would want to call them beings, I don't know.
Half emotions, half logic. Data is somewhere in between a garage door opener and a human being. But where? Sounds like another mission for the Starship Enterprise.
Number one, have you ever considered whether Data is more human or less human than we want?
I only wish we were all as well balanced, sir.
Agreed.
For Philosophy Talk, this is Amy Standen.
Well, thanks to Amy Standen, our roving philosophical reporter, Linda Wetzel, and Data for that very interesting exploration of whether you could really get by with no emotions at all. I'm John Perry. With me is that passionate Kantian from Down Under, Ken Taylor.
And we're joined from Chicago by Professor Martha Nussbaum, where she's the professor of law and ethics. She's also author of Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of Emotions, and more recently, a book focused on two emotions in particular, Disgust and Shame, Hiding from Humanity. Martha, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi, John and Ken. It's really great to be on your show.
Well, it's great to have you here, Martha, and to have somebody who's written so widely and sensitively on our topic, emotions. So you can help us right from the get-go here. Ken and I are having a little trouble figuring out whether emotions or thoughts or sensations are somewhere in between. Seeing, hearing, thinking, planning aren't emotions. What's special about the emotions, and where do they fit into the mental life?
Well, I think you have to ask what kind of thinking we're talking about here. Think about Data saying, it's important for me to know that. And when he said that, his voice started to sound emotional. Now, I think emotions involve a certain kind of thought that I would call an appraisal about what's most important for your own well-being. So, you know, when you're grieving for somebody, that's painful, and no doubt there are feelings of pain that are with it. But it's not just like a stomachache, you know. It's like you see that lost person, and you think that person is gone forever, and that person was very important to me. And without those thoughts, it wouldn't be grief. It would just be indigestion.
Okay, that says that what makes most, that says to me that emotions have some connection to thought. That emotion without thought, emotions are not thoughtless. They're not blind. You know, they have what in the trade, in the jargon, we call intentional content. They're about something, mm-hmm. right? And you said they're partly about me and my well-being, and somehow my perception of the world in relationship to me and my well-being. But is that all an emotion is? A thought as of this is how I am? Right? This is how I am, you know, relative to the world?
I think, first of all, we have to say that's a central part of what they are, that we couldn't define an emotion like grief without mentioning those thoughts, and we couldn't distinguish it from other painful emotions like pity or fear. But then the question is, what other things have to be there? And see, I think that gets very puzzling. I think we do feel intuitively that there got to be some feelings there most of the time, and that we can even say something about what the characteristic feelings are. Fear goes with trembling, grief goes with something like an ache, anger goes with something like a boiling. But do those feelings really have to be there? I mean, what if, for example, I feel anger without this feeling of boiling? I mean, in fact, this is true of me, that I kind of repress my anger and I don't even notice that I'm angry until maybe the next day I have a headache. And so I don't actually think this is true of all people. I think there's a lot of variety between people. And, you know, if you take an emotion like grief, we don't even get started because grief persists over time and we have lots of different feelings associated with it over time. So I guess I think there is a great deal of variety in those feelings, and we wouldn't want to mention any particular one that has to be there.
Martha, at some point you have a very nice way of putting it. You say it would be really nice in a way if emotions were just feelings and you could just rub a little cream on your grief and it would go away, or take right, an aspirin right. and your regret would disappear.
Nice. Yes.
On the other hand, I think, you know, we would be missing something if we just had the cognitive element. Take Ken's example of seeing a bear and thinking, my goodness, there's a dangerous mammal that's about to eat me. The fear motivates us, helps us run. Isn't there a motivational aspect to the feeling that's an important part of emotions?
That can't.
Well, there's
and you have to add, yeah. Martha, you have to add that a mere judgment can't replace that motivational element, doesn't contain
okay,
that.
Okay, but what
element.
You didn't, you said, oh, there's a bear over there. Now, you didn't say, there's something that's threatening me, and it's very important to me that that thing not be there. So it's when you put in the me and the importance for your own well-being, I think we already get a lot closer to an emotion. And then the question is, well, sure, often there is a trembling there, and that might be quite important, but a lot of the time, you know, we are afraid of death. And I think I'm afraid of death all the time, maybe not when I'm asleep, but all the time when I'm awake. But I don't feel a trembling most of the time, and yet that motivation is still there. So the question is, you know, what's motivating me to do things that protect my health when I'm not feeling the trembling? Well, I think the thought is there, and it can kind of get beneath the surface and motivate us.
Now, Martha, I don't want to get personal here, but just looking at the volume and quality of work you've done, I don't think you have a lot of problem getting motivated.
Well, that's not only your philosophical work, but your causes around the world.
Take this both ways, John, because, you know, why do I obsessively do all this stuff? Maybe, I mean, I think the fear of death plays a big role, actually, but I'm not conscious of it. Maybe if I were, I wouldn't be doing as much work.
Yeah, but sometimes when I get out of bed, I think, oh, gosh, look, and I'm having all these me thoughts. Important that I get out of bed. I've got things to do. I'm a schlump if I don't get them done. But there's just this something missing, this caring. And, you know, it kind of comes in installments. First I care enough to get a cup of coffee, and then some more caring hits in. And that all seems to be feeling, and it really seems to me an important part of motivation. You just may miss it because you don't have those kinds of mornings. Or maybe you do.
Well, you know, I think we always say these things to ourselves to rev ourselves up, and that doesn't necessarily mean that we're really believing those things we're saying to ourselves. If a person that you think you're supposed to love has died, you'll say to yourself, oh, my mother has died and she was real important to me. But, you know, you may not actually believe that. And I think what I'm talking about are the thoughts that you really have at some deep level. Those are the ones that get you going.
So the caring is connected with a certain quality of belief and sincerity.
Yeah, a certain really deep quality of belief. And the way that the belief actually organizes your sense of your goals and projects in life.
Folks, you're listening to Philosophy Talk. Our subject today is the emotions. Our guest is Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago.
Do you wish you were more in touch with your emotions or less so? Do they make you more sensible or do they interfere with clear thought?
We'll take your calls in a moment. Philosophy Talk will be right back.
Trying to forget my feelings of love.
Feelings by Morris Albert. I'm John Perry, and I'm here to tell you that that song is not on my iPod.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're discussing emotions, Join us, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
I'm sure you folks out there listening to us have all had emotions that you just wish would go away. But on the whole, do you think emotions help you make decisions, or do they tend to steer you in the wrong direction? You can call us outside the Bay Area at 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. You can also email us at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Our guest today is Professor Martha Nussbaum from the University of Chicago. Martha, I want to go back a second to your characterization of emotions as something having to, don't remember quite how you put it, something about I represent this situation in reference to my well-being. But, you know, that sounds at first blush like that makes the emotions about me. But I care about my son. I care about my country. I care, let's say, about humanity at large. Humanity at large might flourish even, you know, I might sacrifice myself and so not have well-being for the sake of love for humanity, a love for my country, or love for my son. I mean, I'm not, so tell me with that from your perspective.
Okay, yeah. What I am talking about is, I mean, I actually use in the book a technical term, eudaimonistic, to
right.
refer to the fact that we're all pursuing our own conceptions of what a full and well-lived life is. And Aristotle used the word eudaimonia for that. And so the emotions concern things that are part of that conception of what a well-lived life for you is. So they refer to you in that sense. But of course, most of us consider that our friends, our families are in very central parts of a well-lived life. And then many of us may think that social justice is such a part and that people at a distance, therefore, become a part of your well-being. So what I'm saying is whatever you manage to put into that idea of a complete and well-lived life for you, those are the things that your emotions will focus on.
So you might say, well, can you still use the first person in saying my country
right.
and my family
right.
and my children? So you didn't get totally away from it. I think I'm kind of with Martha there.
Well, I just wanted to be clear, right? But again, I guess there's a little puzzle. When I sacrifice myself to my country for my country out of love for my country, how am I acting to promote my own well-being? Is there really any sense in which I'm acting to promote my own well-being? I'm giving up my life.
You know, I mean, Aristotle actually discusses that example, and he says, well, he's choosing for himself the more important thing. I mean, that he's decided it's actually more important for him to do the right thing than to go on living. And therefore, he gets a more complete life by that sacrifice.
Martha, you and a lot of other people that discuss the emotions have considerable discussion of the Stoics, who seem to have a kind of a negative view of the role of emotions in our life that I think you don't completely share. Could you say just a little bit about that?
Well, the Stoics were very worried about the way that anger tears societies apart, particularly in the Roman Empire, which, of course, it did do. And what they thought is that all our emotions involve the idea that there are things outside our control that matter greatly for our well-being. If we could really believe that the only thing of real importance was the state of our own moral perfection, and we also believed that that was fully within our control just by making the right sort of effort, then we wouldn't have occasions for fear. I mean, there's nothing the world could do to you. We wouldn't have anything to lose, so there'd be no grief. And there's nothing anyone else could do to you that would be really important, so we wouldn't have anger. And so they said, well, you know, if you get angry when somebody's insulting you and seating you at the wrong place at the dinner table, or even when you get a bad emperor like Nero who's doing really bad things, just remember, those things are not truly important. You can live a complete and well-lived life without paying any attention at all to those things. So then that was their recommendation, that
so
you just live a life of
attachment. Stoics are kind of like Democrats after the last election.
Well, you know, Bill Clinton did say that he reads the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius, who was a great Stoic, once every year. And, you know, I think when you get angry at your enemies when they're attacking you and slandering you and so on, that's a good book to read because
Martha,
you can use a little detachment.
Martha and John, but then that makes it sounds like the Stoics kind of tried to deny a fact of human life. We are vulnerable in this way to things beyond our control. Our emotions somehow respond to that vulnerability. Why do I get angry at somebody when they slight me? Because, well, I'm vulnerable to the slight. It damages me in some way. If I thought I was invulnerable, then I wouldn't have emotions. But if I recognize my vulnerability, I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, you know, what they thought is you can think it away because you can just tell yourself those are not really important things. The right way, they said, for a father to greet the news of the death of a child is to say, oh, I was already aware that I have begotten a mortal. So, you know, no vulnerability if you think it's not important.
But do you agree with that?
No. No, actually, I think that they're right on about some things, that people do care too much about reputation, about insult, about honor, about money, you know, but we just have to ask, which are the really important things? And it'll turn out that that list will definitely contain some things with respect to which we're vulnerable, like our loved ones, our family.
Jim in Alameda is going to weigh in on this point. Jim, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you. My question, which is directed towards all three of you, is that in some concrete situations, reason and emotion interact. For example, your care and concern, which might have a sympathetic, compassionate, and empathetic side to it and is quite emotional, sometimes has to be regulated through acts of prudence. And this is where practical reason comes into play. It determines the degree to which the emotion ought to be implied in order to render it more effective in a concrete situation. Could you people elaborate on that, please?
Thanks, Jim. Interesting thought. What do you guys think?
Well, I guess I would put it a little differently, because I would want to say there are two different kinds of thinking interacting here. Your compassion is a way of registering the importance of the other person's suffering. But, yeah, I agree with you that that has to be regulated by other forms of thinking, because usually we feel compassion for people that we like who are similar to us, and we don't feel so much compassion for people who are far away or who look bad or, you know, people that we've been taught not to like. And so we need to have definitely other more detached forms of ethical thinking to regulate that compassion, to tell us that the fact that somebody's another race doesn't mean you don't have the same compassion for them.
Martha, that raises a more general point. Again, John and I talked about this earlier on, that many philosophers have wanted to deny, right, that the emotions have any role in a kind of morally good life. Kant is the prime example here, right? So you have when you're moved by your emotions, you're almost necessarily not moved by that which gives your life true moral worth or something like that, gives your action true moral worth. I mean, it sounds like, on your view, that can't be right, given what emotions are.
Yeah, on my view, it can't be right. Now, Kant actually thought that emotions were sub-thought. They were not forms of thought. He didn't spend much time on that. He didn't defend that position. And so I don't think he made a big contribution in this area. But even he, at one point, does say that people who don't have enough motivation to care for the sick had better go around and beef up their compassion by visiting sick rooms and hospitals.
Well,
so he wasn't quite as austere.
Good for Kant. Good old guy when you get down to basics. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, folks. The number here is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. We're discussing the emotions with Martha Nussbaum, toll-free 1-800-525-9917.
Or send us comments at comments@philosophytalk.org if you happen not to be in the continental U.S. like me.
Now, we've got an email here from Pete in San Francisco. I think that's the same Pete that often sends us very insightful questions. Do the creative arts offer a window into understanding emotion? Some of the great paintings, films, books, and pieces of music that have moved people for centuries seem to come from extreme emotional responses. In particular, I'm thinking of Dostoevsky, the abstract expressionists, and so forth. Well, I know, Martha, you're going to have some thoughts about that.
Oh, yeah, I think that's a great question. I think not only do they offer many examples, but they tell us something about what we ought to be saying about the nature of the thought involved in emotions, namely that we shouldn't be saying that all thought is verbal thought or even easily verbalizable. There's intelligent thought in pictures. There's intelligent thought in music. And, yeah, I'm really interested in the emotional expression in music. And in my book I talk a lot about Gustav Mahler, but of course in every kind of music there is this issue that music seems full of emotion, and yet we don't quite know how to talk about that. Well, I think that's because we haven't recognized that other forms of symbolic activity can be fully intelligent and can contain ideas of salience and importance, even though we can't easily represent those in words.
Martha, doesn't music kind of represent a slight challenge to your view? Because it seems to me when I listen to music, I'm often full of emotion that doesn't have much content. It doesn't seem to be any particular thoughts or propositions connected with it. What do you think of that?
Well, I guess I think that it often has a content that's highly vague and general. Of course, in a way, my choice of Mahler makes it easier for me because his music is relatively programmatic. But I think often music does have emotions that are in a very general way connected with ideas of fear, ideas of loss and emptiness, which may not involve a specific situation, a specific representation. But that doesn't, that in a way, it makes them all the more powerful because I think they're closely related to thoughts that we have when we were young children, when we don't even have the concept of an object yet, but we still have very powerful emotions about our vulnerability in the world around us.
Martha, I want to go back to your view about emotions, emotion as a form of thinking. I mean, it's not just thinking, it's a particular kind of form of thinking. What happens? Look, sometimes anger clouds my judgment. I'm overcome with rage, right? And I just can't think clearly about what I ought to do, right? So how do I reconcile that? I mean, it seems like the you know, this Kantian idea that the emotions somehow are these not always good sources of motivation or whatever, that there's something right about that. I wonder how that fits in your view. What do I do when I'm in a fit of rage and I'm trying to think?
Yeah, you know, I think it's very different. The way anger clouds thought is very different from the way that, let's say, hunger clouds thought. When you're hungry, you just you can't think because your body is distracting you with all these signals. When anger is clouding thought, it's because it introduces a dissonant kind of thought. It's saying, me, 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 I was wronged, and you did this to me. And that often clouds other kinds of thought that we might have about what we should be doing and whether this person really did that and so on. So it's often a primitive kind of thought, too. And once again, I want to go back to the fact that we form a lot of our emotions, and particularly our anger, at a time when we really aren't thinking very well because we're tiny babies. And so very often in our anger, it surges up this very infantile part of the personality that doesn't really think very well. But that doesn't mean it's not thinking.
Let me one more point here, just to press this just a little bit. I get what you're saying, but again, thoughts are the kind of thing, at least beliefs and judgments are the kind of thing that can be true or false. Anger doesn't seem true or false. It seems appropriate or inappropriate. It might be inappropriate when it's based on some false judgment, but the anger itself doesn't seem to be the kind of thing that's either true or false. It just seems, you know, not suitable to the situation or something like that. Which isn't the same as being true or false.
I mean, let's spell it out a little. I mean, the content, let's say, of the anger is, you're a terrible threat to my well-being because you've done something really, really bad to me. Now, that could be true or false in a lot of different ways. It could be false because you didn't really do it. It could be false because you're not a real threat to me. You're just not that important. It could be false in lots of different ways. So I think that once we say very clearly what the content of a particular emotion is, it can be true and false.
Michelle, you have something to say about this? Tell us all about how it looks from Belmont.
Yes. Actually, what I was interested in was the fact that early Christian monastic theology has a very detailed treatment of emotions and their relationship to thoughts. And it's based on a combination of Stoic philosophy, Platonic philosophy, and their own experiences in terms of dealing with their emotional states, especially since they're living in isolation as hermits. And what the origin of what we now know as the seven deadly sins, lust, anger, gluttony, avarice, envy, etc., were actually originally described as emotional states that impeded and clouded the monk's judgment as to the true condition of his or her existence. And so I think a lot of the later philosophers lost knowledge of that tradition, and it's affected the way that we look at emotions and the way that and how we deal with emotions.
Thanks for that, Michelle. Interesting historical perspective, and I always like to hear the seven deadly sins recited. It just kind of makes me feel at home. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can reach us at 415-841-4134 or toll free at 1-800-525-9917.
Or
so
via
Martha,
the web.
Or via the web, yeah.
Comments at philosophytalk.org.
So what do you guys think about the seven deadly sins?
Well, you know, I think what he says is very, very interesting, and I am interested in the way that the Christian tradition overthrew the Stoic idea that we should live a low, emotionless lives. Now, while it's true that there were some emotional states that were bad, it was also very important to Augustine, for example, to say the real Christian life is a very emotion-laden life because we are vulnerable creatures. We are vulnerable because we are cut off from the highest good, and we are longing for grace, but we can't bring it about. So therefore, our life is suffused with longing, with grief, with fear that we might not get that grace. And so it's just a question of taking the right object rather than these bad objects that most people attach their emotions to.
Martha, your book, the subtitle of your book is The Intelligence of Emotions. And, you know, people sometimes talk about emotional intelligence. There's this thing we were talking about a little bit ago about the inappropriateness or appropriateness of anger in a situation. I mean, how does one come to have emotions that are, you know, rightly tuned to the situation that one faces? I mean, it seems that, you know, you can be such that your emotions are all out of whack with the situation you find yourself in, or they can be kind of appropriate for the situation. That seems to me like a kind of deep and important thing. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think we all have a lot of problems on that score just because we start out as little babies and we don't control anything, but yet we think we should control everything. And so I guess the process of becoming a reasonable adult is to try to figure out what we should be claiming for ourselves and what we shouldn't be claiming for ourselves, and not to have a kind of overweening anger against people because they don't wait at our every beck and call. And that's a hard task because we really do want to control the world, and we don't want to die, and all these things. So I think it's just part and parcel of living an ethical life and trying to figure out what's worth caring about and what isn't worth caring about. And sometimes we also have to tell ourselves we should care more about certain things. I mean, the lack of anger can also cloud judgment. If you're, let's say, in a group that's been oppressed for generations, you may not have anger at that situation. You may have gotten used to it. I see a lot of women in my development work who don't yet have anger at the situation they're in. They're not able to go to school. They are malnourished. They can't read or write and so on. You know, and they don't have enough anger, I would say. So to teach ourselves to have the right emotions is part and parcel of figuring out how we should live.
Now, let me just interject a Humean point here, though. We've got these two things. We've got this figuring out and we've got this caring. And you've been talking about figuring out what we should and shouldn't care about. But can we do that in a vacuum? Don't we need to have some primitive caring that kind of, and actually in your theory, you say, well, we start out caring about ourselves. We come out of the womb, which you have a nice description of this I meant to write down and quote about leaving this wonderful environment. And all of a sudden the birth of us is the birth of our emotions. Do we ever logically or structurally get rid of that primitive caring? And isn't that the source of all the judgments?
That's a big question, Martha. Why don't we let that hang in the air for just a minute? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're discussing emotions with Martha Nussbaum.
We'd like to hear from you. Do emotions help you lead an ethical life, or do they get in the way of doing the right thing?
We'll get to more calls and emails when Philosophy Talk continues.
Mariah Carey and emotions. That's the topic of our program. I'm John Perry, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence, and I would put that on my iPod. I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic today is the indispensable emotions. What are your thoughts on emotions? Are they really indispensable, as we've been saying, or do you disagree about that? Join us by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
Hey, and you folks outside the Bay Area, you can call in. We've had all Bay Area calls so far. 1-800-525-9917. That's 1-800-525-9917. And you can email us, comments@philosophytalk.org. And Philip has a question or a comment.
Hi. I find that intuition is my most powerful tool in decision-making. I can look through the rational lens and get all of the parameters of a decision, but ultimately, with all the variables in the world, it seems like I rely on intuition in the end, and it is tied to emotion. I think it comes from a similar part of our being. And I'm just wondering what you think about that as a process of decision making.
Philip, are you thinking about decisions like what the best way to drive to L.A. is, or are you thinking about more like right and wrong kinds of things?
Definitely more like right and wrong type of things, but things that have no obvious, like the right way to go to L.A. can be very rationally decided, and that would be the proper methodology. But if you have a subject that's far more complicated than analysis can allow, then we often refer to our intuition. In fact, a lot of business executives have started, the ones that are the most successful, I've read reports that they actually often rely on their intuition in their decision making. They get their facts and all their background, but in the end they go on a gut feeling, and so that becomes a very powerful tool, and being able to rely on that intuition and understand it is critical, I think.
Okay, great question, Phil. Thanks a lot.
So, Martha, what do you think?
Yeah, well, I guess I agree with him that intuition and emotion are closely connected, but I guess I'm more skeptical than he is about the role in decision-making, because I think we call something a gut feeling or an intuition. Often what we're talking about is something that's very habitual, that's been buried through early learning, and it just bubbles up. And we didn't think we thought about that, but it was just there. And sometimes our habits are good, and sometimes they're very bad. I say in the book that I learned as a kid that the U.S. Supreme Court was in California. So, you know, I used to have intuitions about where it was and what was happening there that would involve the picture of a map of the U.S. and things were going on the West Coast. And my colleagues were flying to the West Coast to argue a case before the Supreme Court. And it was all because I'd heard the words Earl Warren and California combined a lot of times, you know. And I think we have intuitions of a similar kind about, you know, what women can do, what people of other races are capable of. And these feel like, you know, pretty solid gut feelings. But if you look historically, we probably just learned them through hearing things from our parents. And sometimes that's right, but sometimes it's very, very wrong.
John, I want to give you a chance to go back to the question that we left hanging. I don't remember exactly what it was, but I'm sure you do.
Well, I was just saying, isn't caring, some kind of primitive caring that precedes any kind of judgment about what's worth caring about, doesn't that remain the basis of our whole intellectual life, even if we get more and more sophisticated about what we care about? I mean, I'm still a little unhappy with maybe that you're over-intellectualizing the emotions, Martha.
Well, I guess I don't think we're disagreeing that much, John, because I guess I would agree that when we come into the world, there is a very primitive kind of self-concern that does remain, and the I never goes away. I mean, that's why I think that the reference to the I is my life and so on is in all of our emotions, however sophisticated they are. And I don't even think the Stoics are right to want to get rid of that. I mean, I think the Stoics and also various religions, Buddhism, for example, have wanted to completely divest us of the I and therefore to give us something that I would call not an emotional life at all. But then the question is, what do we have left? And, you know, I think what we have left is probably so detached and so distant that it wouldn't be enough to motivate concern with people anywhere. So I wouldn't recommend it.
Marcia, there's some psychological work that shows that people who have a impaired capacity for emotion just can't make any reasonable decisions. I mean, if you in fact lacked the capacity for emotion, you couldn't really live a sensible life, it turns out.
Yeah, they're like what Spock would be like if he were really consistently imagined, because they nothing stands out as more important than anything else, and so they don't really know which direction to move in, unless somebody orders them to do it or something. But otherwise, the world just isn't carved up into things that are objects of care, and it's just meaningless.
So emotional responses to the world are a way of perceiving the world as mattering to me in these or that ways, right? I mean,
yeah.
Right, and without that, the world wouldn't matter. It would be devoid of mattering.
Our number here in the Bay Area is 415-841-4134, and John in San Francisco has a comment.
So I was going to mention that I remember reading some brain researchers had discovered in the old brain in humans the specific locations of our basic emotions, and that the new brain was the brain that was trying to control this basic these primitive feelings, and that they're just part of our biology and something that we all have to deal with. And that, I suppose, is philosophy is an attempt to explain the, how the new brain controls the old brain and these emotions.
Well, that's a very interesting idea, John. So we may, maybe Hume is kind of an old brain philosopher and Kant's a new brain philosopher. What do you guys think about that?
Well, let's put the question this way, Martha. Suppose that it turned out that all the emotions were just rooted in the old brain and so not in higher cognition. Would that be kind of a scientific refutation of your idea that emotion is a form of, you know, high-level thought?
Well, no, it depends what you mean by rooted in. Now, actually, people like Joseph Ledoux, who write very subtly and rigorously about this, don't say that fear is in the amygdala. They say that there's something in the activity of the amygdala that are a basis for fear. But he actually says, well, it wouldn't be full-blown fear until you have something further. And I think he really does include the element of thinking about your situation. And then when you get to emotions like compassion, I don't think anyone would even try to say that you could have that without having very complicated forms of thinking. In fact, when they talk about can animals have compassion, they ask, are they capable of taking up the position of another person? Do they have perspectival thinking and so on?
Let me, one last point. So your view seems to directly entail that people like Kant, who wanted to kind of banish the emotions in some sense from ethics, are just fundamentally wrong. That ethics really has to be, since the emotions are ways of perceiving, cognizing the world, representing the world to us as mattering to us, and ethics is all about kind of what matters and how we should behave, then it seems like ethics has to have, for you, the emotions have to have a very large role in ethics. Is that right?
I think that's right, but I guess the question is, how deep a critique of Kant is this? Because he didn't spend much time on the emotions. I think he has a fundamentally unreflective conception of what they are. Now, suppose he had had a richer conception of what they are, then what would he have said? Now, I think he would still be troubled by the element of the I, the reference to yourself in emotion. But maybe he wouldn't have been as troubled as the Stoics, because he does think that we all legitimately pursue our own happiness and that that's something that we should even help other people to do. It's just that there's a more impartial element to thought that has to regulate that. And I don't say anything against that. So I don't really think of myself as offering a critique of Kant, actually.
Yeah, well, but when philosophers think that we should be moved by a kind of picture of the options objectively, where we don't take ourselves into account, something you find both in Kantians and utilitarians, is that the same as getting the emotions out? Or could you have this objective view and at the same time think emotions were an important part of it?
Well, I think once you decide that a certain view is correct, then it's your job in developing your own personality to get those things to matter to you. And if you think it would be good for me to think much more about the well-being of people in developing countries, then you better go out and work on yourself and get those things to matter to you at more than a superficial level. So I think we do have a task. And I mean, when Peter Singer writes about animals, I can see that he already, and for probably his whole life, he's made the well-being of animals a central part of his life. I kind of came to the conclusion that he was right intellectually about animals, and I'm not a tremendous animal lover. And so I have the task of, you know, working on myself so that I see my food differently, so that I see animals differently. And, you know, I think we can do that.
Well, Martha, thanks so much for joining us. It's been a wonderful conversation.
Thanks very much. I think you have a great program, and keep going.
Okay.
Our guest today has been Martha Nussbaum, professor of law and ethics from the University of Chicago, that great place, that's my alma mater. She's the author of Upheavals of Thought, The Intelligence of Emotions, and more recently, Hiding from Humanity, Disgust, Shame, and the Law.
And we also want to thank the callers we didn't have time for and a couple of interesting emails that we just couldn't get to. Thanks so much.
So, John, what are you thinking today? What did you learn? What are you feeling today, I should say?
Well, I sometimes tell the kids in my class that philosophy is the one discipline where they should know less when at the end of the hour after hearing my lecture than they did when they came in. And with respect to the emotions, I guess that's the way I feel. I kind of had a simple-minded view of the emotions. It's mostly feeling with a little patina of thought, and Martha has really challenged that. And she's such a learned an insightful person, it's you have to really rethink your views when you talk to her.
Well, that's certainly true. I mean, she seems to know everything in the history of philosophy. And I'm sort of like you. I think there is a deep and important connection between emotion and thought. I really do. I do think that emotions are at least tied up with thinking, with representing the world, with, you know, what we philosophers called cognizing the world. But I do think there's something different, there's something distinctive that's a non-thought element about an emotion, you know? So that non-thought element plays an important part in the power of emotions to move us. And so I'm not sure I'm entirely convinced of Martha's view, but I do think it's wrong to think that emotions just cloud thought. I mean, that's a mistake, I think.
Well, emotions can cloud thought. They can clarify thought. I'm still a little inclined to think there's some basic phenomenon of caring that's in some sense precognitive and pre-thought, and you can't totally squeeze the feeling out of emotions, although it certainly plays a less important role in the way we think about, individuate, and classify emotions than one might have thought.
John, I think you should follow up on this by blogging about the emotions. You know, I think you should have it out a little bit more, because I'm puzzled about your notion of primitive caring. I'd want to hear more, you know?
Well, so, I'll try to get myself motivated to care about that and care about it passionately, and then I'll get it done. Well, we've talked about Kant and lots of other people, Kant, Hume, the Stoics, and their opinions on emotions. What about Spinoza? Here to tell us is Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes, W. Somerset Maugham, took the title of his novel, Of Human Bondage, from a 17th century book by philosopher Benedictus Spinoza, The Ethics. And what, according to Spinoza, holds us in bondage? Our emotions. Specifically, for Spinoza, there was only one emotion, desire. Love, hate, envy, hunger, all stem from that. He wrote, "Desire is the essence of a man." For Spinoza, we are creatures of desire, driven by that which brings us either pleasure or pain. He has been credited with sowing the seeds of modern psychology and behaviorism. He's also been called the father of the Enlightenment and influenced such philosophers as Santayana and Bertrand Russell. He was also the favorite philosopher of Albert Einstein, who wrote, "I believe in Spinoza's God reveals himself in the harmony of all that exists." Spinoza identified God with the universe and rejected all organized religion. He believed in an individual morality and that there is no reality beyond the laws of nature, therefore no miracles and no prophecy. We are self-serving egotists. Such ideas, no doubt, were what got him not just excommunicated from, but shunned by the Jewish faith when he was just 23. Spinoza knew his beliefs were controversial, and he kept a low profile. He even turned down a lecturing position at Heidelberg in favor of his lowly career as a lens grinder. This occupation probably hastened his death of tuberculosis at the age of 45 in 1677. The Ethics, like most of his work, was not published in his lifetime. For years after his death, his name was synonymous with atheism, and he is still blamed by some today for liberal sins, situational ethics, the cult of the individual, secular humanism. Now, true, there are no transcendent ideals in Spinoza and no sins. He viewed the world as substance and God as the perfect substance, devoid of morality. Paradoxically, Spinoza's notion of virtue comes from egotism. Good and evil are just functions of things we do and do not desire. If it gives us pleasure, it's good. If it causes pain, it's bad. Further, he wrote, we do not desire things because they are good, but rather we call those things good, which we desire. But these vary from person to person, and even inside one person from day to day or minute to minute. So desire leads to confusion and conflict. This is the human bondage which Spinoza wrote about. How then to be free? Through contemplation. The mind is not capable of understanding anything higher than God, a being absolutely infinite, and without which nothing can either be or be conceived. Therefore, the mind's highest utility, or good, is the knowledge of God. The mind's absolute virtue is to understand. Therefore, the highest virtue of the mind is to understand God. Yes, to Spinoza, even God can be understood. If you have the desire, and you put your mind to it, think about it. I gotta go.
Wow, Ken, my head is dizzy from 60 seconds of rapid-fire philosophy.
If your head is dizzy, that means you've got a conundrum in your mind, and we can solve it for you, can't we, John?
Yes. Go to our webpage,
conundrums@philosophytalk.org, or hit that conundrums button on the webpage. We won't promise to solve your problem, but we will give you lots of new ways to think about it.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Minella Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University.
Our executive producer is Gordon Earle.
Special thanks to Rujun Shen, Nicole Sawaya, Ben Temption, and Alan Farley.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
Also from various groups at Stanford University, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, and the members of KALW Information Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
The conversation continues on our website, www.philosophytalk.org. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.